we have visitors here today, and we'd like to have them stand up and tell us who they are. We have Michigan High School. For those who are from Michigan, stand. They grew fine. Good, thank you. And I understand there's going to be more Michigan students later in the day. Since we know who you are now, I'd like to carry on the practice of letting you know who we are. The Chief Justice is obvious by her absence, and then Justice William Babbage would be in the next chair, and then Justice Jeanine Geske would normally be in the next chair, but the two ladies are not participating in this case. Then we have Justice Patrick Crooks, and to my right it's Justice Ann Walsh Bradley, and medium upright it's Justice John Wilcox, and I'm Don Steinmetz, just a beat away from Chief Justice. So, let's call the first case. It's 960680, Wisconsin Voice of Christian Youth et al. Versus St. Paul Fire and Marine Insurance Company. I have a division here, see if it's correct. Terry Johnson will be doing 10 minutes and a 5-minute rebuttal. The James Argas, did they get your first name right?
Yeah.
Okay. we'll be arguing 15 minutes. Then there will be an intervener, defendant, respondent, and attorney Arnold Anderson will be arguing that cause. All right, so we call first then on Terry Johnson.
Attorney Terry Johnson.
Thank you. May it please the court. I am here representing the appellants, WVCY, Wisconsin Voice of Christian Youth, and Mr. Elias, Reverend Eliason, in this appeal from the decision of the District 1 Court of Appeals affirming the decision of Judge Gardner granting summary judgment in favor of St. Paul. Under the time split which we have worked out with the other appellant employers represented by Mr. Gass, I'm going to be restricting my remarks to two issues. The first issue is the question of whether there is coverage for the alleged liability of my clients for negligent supervision of its employees, and second of all, whether there is coverage for the slander of title claim. The remaining issues will be addressed by Mr. Gass in his time. We suggest to the court that all this court needs to do on the negligent supervision claim is correct one error that was made by the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals indicated there were three steps that needed to be resolved in favor of the appellants in order to find coverage and reverse the summary judgment that was granted in favor of St. Paul. It resolved the first two steps of that analysis in favor of the appellants, and we believe correctly. We believe it erred in finding the third step should be resolved against the appellants. The first step is that the Court of Appeals properly found that the emotional distress claims alleged by the plaintiffs in this action, particularly by Ms. Doyle, fell within the bodily injury coverage of the policy because they constituted sickness within the meaning of the policy under the Terra N decision. The second step is that the Court of Appeals correctly found that, as did WVCY, the filing of the false lien claim was an event within the meaning of the policy because it was an accident under the negligent supervision claim. In other words, under the policy, it was accidental that this happened because the negligent supervision claim by its very nature assumes that it was not intended, and that brings it within that portion of the policy coverage as constituting an event. Where the Court of Appeals erred was that it found that the intentional acts exclusion under the policy eliminated coverage despite that. The court found that the policy excluded bodily injury, quote, expected or intended by the protected person, and I emphasize the word the, because as our brief indicates, that's an essential issue in the case. The complaint alleges that Mr. Kanz acted intentionally in filing this lien claim, and for purposes of this appeal, at least, that's not an issue. It's alleged that he acted intentionally, and that's what determines whether there's coverage. The Court of Appeals erroneously held that that meant there was not coverage for WVCY. We suggest that this is incorrect for several reasons. First of all, the policy, unlike any of the others, with the exception of one of the sexual acts case, the Jessica case, which is discussed in briefs, which we believe is distinguishable on that basis, the policy in this case is completely unlike any of the others. St. Paul drafted a policy which makes it clear under the separability of insurance that each insured is entitled to separate individual coverage and therefore separate individual coverage determination, as if there was no other insured, and apart from whatever coverage considerations might exist with regard to another insured. So by the very language of the policy, combined with the language that says that the policy only excludes bodily injury expected or intended by the protected person rather than by any protected person or by any single protected person, the policy makes it clear that there is, in effect, two entirely separate insurance policies here. There is one which by its terms applies to Mr. Cans, and we don't dispute the fact that that policy doesn't provide any coverage for the claims alleged against Mr. Cans because they are alleged to be intentional and therefore allege an injury expected or intended by Mr. Cans as the protected person under that policy. But there is, in effect, a completely separate policy, and that policy says that WVCY, as a separate person insured under that policy, is covered for the reasons the Court of Appeals said, unless you find that the injury in question, the harm that Ms. Doyle claims she sustained, the sickness in the form of the emotional injury and distress, was expected or intended by WVCY as the protected person under that policy. Now, we did not choose the language of this policy. St. Paul did. As some of the other cases indicate, they were clear, free to pick other words in the policy if they wished to do so. They could have said, for example, expected or intended by any one or more of the protected persons under the policy, in which case the meaning they would now have you ascribe to this policy would be rather apparent on its face and the exclusion would apply.
Mr. Johnson, let me interrupt if I might and ask you a question. In regard to the negligent supervision claim that's in the complaint, the amended complaint, how does that differ from a claim of vicarious liability?
It differs because vicarious liability attaches to, for example, WVCY, if it was being vicariously liable, whether or not it has committed any independent wrong. It is respondeat superior. It says, you were acting on my behalf, this person was acting on behalf of the defendant's behalf, at the time of the tort, and the defendant is therefore automatically liable, no matter what it did or didn't do. This claim specifically says, if you recognize the tort in the Miller case, which is not the issue here, but if you recognize it, it says there was an independent wrongful act, albeit a negligent one, by WVCY that was committed. And it is by virtue of that independent wrongful act, the negligence of WVCY, that WVCY is sought to be held liable.
Is that why you feel the language in regard to the protected person is so important?
Correct. It is a combination of the fact that the policy makes it clear that each protected person is entitled to have coverage determined based upon the allegations against that protected person and the fact that the allegation against WVCY is not of intentionally wrongful conduct. No one has alleged it. Instead, what is alleged at issue in the claims that are involved in this appeal is, were we negligent? Did we commit a negligent act that caused the harm?
So, for example, just give me an example of the types of conduct.
I have a couple, if you'd like.
Okay, yeah, that's what I... Yeah.
For example, if instead of the facts of this case, this arose out of Reverend Eliason running the business as an officer of the corporation, having a discussion with a customer, and decides he wants to have it in private, so he walks out on the top of a stairwell above a concrete platform, and he has this discussion with this customer, and in the course of the discussion becomes irate and hits the customer, intentionally strikes the customer. And the customer tries to steady himself or herself against a railing at the top of the stairs, and the railing gives way because it was negligently maintained in violation of the Safe Play statute. And a suit is brought against Mr. Eliason for intentionally striking that person, and a claim is brought against WVCY for negligently maintaining the railing and violating the Safe Play statute. St. Paul would tell you WVCY has no coverage for the negligence claims against it because Reverend Eliason, under my hypothetical, acted intentionally wrongfully. I would tell you that's obviously not correct. WVCY, under that example, just as under this case, is entitled to have its coverage determined by what it did or didn't do, and all that's alleged is that it acted negligently.
Is that different from same discussion, no railing, pulls out a weapon and strikes the person, then that would be clearly excluded, correct?
the claim against Reverend Eliason for striking him would be. I don't know what the strength or weakness of that negligence claim against WBC Iowa would be, just as I'm not here to debate the strength or weakness of the negligent supervision claim against WBCY. But if there was a claim brought against WBCY that said injuries were caused not just by the fact that Reverend Eliason did something, but by the fact that you were negligent in an independent way by failing to have a railing there, that would be covered under this policy.
Mr. Johnson, for you to prevail then, don't we necessarily have to decide the issue, which we have held in abeyance in the Walmart case, that there does exist in the state of Wisconsin a cause of action for negligent supervision?
I would put it slightly different, but I think essentially agree with you. If there is no claim for negligent supervision, this issue becomes moot because they can't pursue the claim, which then brings us to the slander of title claim, if I can move to that.
I may before.
You certainly may.
Thank you. Even if there is a cause of action for negligent supervision, it seems to me there's another question, and that is, does that cause of action have as an element the underlying intentional action of the employee? And if the answer to that is yes, then don't you have problems with your argument? If a element of the cause of action of negligent supervision is an intentional act. Would you respond to that? Because you're saying then the intentional acts exclusion in your case doesn't apply. But I'm saying if there's an element of the cause of action, then maybe it would apply.
It still would not apply because the claim against WBCY remains its negligence.
An element of its negligence is an underlying intentional act.
Let me give you another example. I think it illustrates it. If WBCY were instead being sued for negligence in failing to provide security on its premises, and some outside person came in and assaulted Ms. Doyle on the premises, and there was an exclusion for an intentional act in this policy, the fact that that intruder has no coverage under the policy and is clearly, even if he had coverage, would be excluded, doesn't mean WBCY would not be entitled to be covered for its negligence, alleged, in failing to provide adequate security. The fact that someone else is acting intentionally under this policy doesn't say anything about whether the protected person, WBCY, is entitled to be covered for negligence.
I don't see your hypothetical having a cause of action as part of the element of the cause of action in your hypothetical, an underlying intentional act. It might be a condition precedent, but it's not an element of the cause of action.
As a matter of fact, Your Honor, Madam Justice, I suggest otherwise, that part of this is you have to prove not only that this intentional act occurred, but that the negligent person knew or should have known those kinds of negligent act or intentional acts would occur in order to prove they were negligent in the first place. So it is an intentional part of that claim.
Your red light is on, Mr. Johnson. Now, do you have something that has to be said before you sit down?
If I could say one comment on the slander case,
sure.
Since I never got to that, Mr. Justice.
As I came on the bench, the Chief Justice said, watch the red lights. So I'm watching the red light.
And you are doing an admirable job of it. The essential issues on the slander claim are twofold. Number one, is there ambiguity in the reference to libel or slander? It is apparent from the other cases that we've cited that some insurance carriers do specifically say whether or not they cover slander of title. If you don't find an ambiguity there, I would agree with you, there's no coverage. I think it is ambiguous in view of the authorities we've cited. Second, if you find there is coverage because of ambiguity, we suggest that the court, under its prior rulings dealing with illusory coverage, would have to find that saying we cover, in effect, slander of title, if you find this to be construed to apply to that, but we don't cover false statements, renders the libel or slander coverage entirely illusory. We admit there are some claims that do not involve intentionally false statements under libel and defamation law. They are so infrequent that to allow St. Paul to apply that exclusion that way essentially deprives our client of the coverage it got under the policy.
Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Johnson.
You.
Now I know why, Mr. Gass, I was confused by the name of James. I know you as Rick. So you may proceed.
It's a good story about how the James got tacked on, but we don't have time for that.
No.
Well, you can use that time and...
let me do something, a couple of things real quickly with you. And that is to refocus you, because we've also focused in on the intentional acts here. And yet, what you need to know is that WVCY
is a much broader entity and involved in much more than just a Christian broadcasting station. It does do broadcasting, but it runs schools, it runs seminars, and of particular interest is the seminar schooling called the NCLLF that it runs, National Civil Liberties Legal Foundation. It is out of that seminar that came the teaching about the common law liens and the true bills that end up being a major part of this case. It runs a youth ministry, it runs camps, it has vans, trucks, it has a 32-passenger bus, it does rallies and gatherings, it does tapes and books. And all of that comes from the agent who wrote the policy and the policy itself. Now, the significance of that is, when we look at, should St. Paul be in here covering part of this, that tells us that logically they should. There are two policies here, a broadcast policy, which my client wrote, and then the CGL policy. This entity that was insured, Vic Eliason, Reverend Eliason, and the WVCY, does much more than just broadcasting. And the claims against WVCY in this case are much broader than mere defamation and intentional acts. There's a claim that there was negligent notarization here. Now, those of us who got our notaries years ago would have thought, how could I ever be responsible for some negligence claim arising out of an abortion protest situation that would involve a notary? But the allegation is that WVCY negligently allowed a notary on staff to notarize that true bill.
That's not before us, though, is it, Mr. Gass?
Oh, it is.
I thought that the only claims that started out to be 11 causes of action and the counts that remain in dispute involve negligent supervision, slander of title, and invasion of privacy.
It's part of the general negligence that's pled against WVCY. It's part of the overall negligence claim. It's tucked in there in paragraph 70, if I remember right.
But isn't our focus, the focus of this review, whether or not there is coverage for the three causes of action listed by Justice Babbage, isn't there? I mean, maybe I'm wrong.
It's part of
coverage on those three causes of action. There's no contest as to whether or not there's coverage for a negligent notarization claim, is there?
Judge Gardner threw us out of court completely. It is part of it. It's part of the total summary judgment here. Just like the slander of title we were throwing out of court on.
You really got me confused, Mr. Gass. I thought you were going to address the invasion of privacy issue.
No, I would. As I heard Terry's argument develop, there were things that I wanted to add into that.
Okay.
So, if I could do that.
But when you bring in notarization, and that's the first time I've heard of it, I thought I was very thoroughly prepared.
Yeah. No, it's in the briefs. It's an issue in the briefs. Now, where I wanted to take you next, once you realize the broad focus of WVCY's activities, the next place I want to take you is an exclusion to the intentional acts exclusion. And the exclusion in the exclusion is for the protection of people. And that's a quote. So the intentional acts exclusion doesn't apply if the persons are acting for the protection of people. And inside of the complaint, in this case, by reference, are the newspaper articles that quote the WVCY people and the rally participants that were on site. And here are the quotes, particularly from Katie, who was the one who was allegedly kicked. Quote, Katie prayed that God would deliver the babies. In a telephone interview, she gave a reason for continuing to demonstrate, quote, I think that I can't quit going out to protect babies because they are dying and it's my duty to protect them. I'm not going outside the record. I'm not even going outside of the complaint. At these are all in the co-petitioner's appendix at 43, 44. All I did was stand there peacefully trying to protect an innocent child.
But Mr. Gay, I hate to interrupt you again, but I'm going to, because your time is limited. As I understand, we are reviewing a decision of the Court of Appeals.
Right.
And the issue that you were going to address was the issue that the Court of Appeals addressed with respect to invasion of privacy. And the Court of Appeals held that there was no invasion of privacy because the broadcast exclusion of the policy excluded it. Is that, am I wrong?
Wrong in the sense that is what I decided to cover this morning.
Is anybody going to talk about the invasion of privacy?
I was not. No. Now, the whole purpose, Mr. Gass, let me follow up on Justice Babich's question, if I might, for a minute. My understanding that the other side in this case takes the position that the invasion of privacy issue is not before this court, that it was not an issue that was raised in the petition for review. Is that why both you and Mr. Johnson are not addressing it?
Well, it's addressed in Mr. Johnson's brief. It's not addressed in ours. And that's why I felt uncomfortable with me addressing it. Now,
what issue are you addressing?
I'm going to do some backstopping on the negligent supervision, but focusing on the intentional act exclusion.
Okay.
And so where I've got you to this point is a recognition of the broadness of the activities of WVCY. Secondly, got you focused on the exclusion to the intentional act exclusion. And now I want to take you to the third step, and that is, even if in Miller versus Walmart, you decide that you're not going to recognize a negligent supervision cause of action, this case still should be reversed and sent back down because of the very simple and traditional rule that you can't determine intent on affidavits. So even if you hold against us on the negligent supervision, which I don't think you should, but you still should reverse, because intent can't be determined on affidavits. It's uniquely, as this court has said time and again, an issue of state of mind that has to be determined in a trial, and especially in this unique set of facts where the state of mind relates to these abortion protesters who believe that their purpose out on that street on that day was to protect people. But I said, I don't think you should pass by the negligent supervision and not make it a cause of action. And I'd like to return to Justice Bradley's question about, does there necessarily have to be an intentional act underneath for that to be a cause of action? The example I would give you is this. McDonald's Corporation does a wonderful job of hiring the developmentally disabled to work in its restaurants. If one of those persons does an act for which they could not be responsible because of their mental condition, but it's causative of injury to somebody, you could have a situation where the underlying actor neither acted negligently or intentionally, but causative in fact of injury. And I believe it's good public policy, in accordance with the constitutional provision in Wisconsin, to find remedies for wrongs, that there ought to be a cause of action for negligent supervision. Now that's...
But Mr. Gass, if we hold in Walmart, the case that we're presently holding in advance, but if we should ultimately decide that there is no tort of negligent supervision, what do we send it back for under that issue?
In our case?
Yeah.
You said that
even if we decide there's no tort of negligent supervision, we should still reverse on this cause of action.
Right. Because there has to be a trial on the facts of whether there was intentional conduct here. In an intent, when we're going to apply intent, jury has to determine, was there an intentional act? Secondly, was there an act that was intended to commit harm? And then in this case, you add on a third factual determination that needs to be made, were the acts done in protection of people?
So that's one reason why it has to go back, irrespective of negligent supervision. The second reason it has to go back is because of the slander of title issue that Mr. Johnson addressed. Whether that's covered within the undefined term in the St. Paul policy of slander. They could have defined it, they didn't. CGS put slander of title inside of the general topic, libel and slander. And so I think a reasonable expectation of an insured would be that likewise slander of title would fall within it. And then you have to send it back because of the claim of the negligent notarization, which leads to the true bill and all of that. So in this case, although at first blush, negligent supervision, that cause of action and the coverage for it and the issue of severability grabbed the headlines, this is nothing more than a trial court having made a mistake on the simple issue of how do you determine intent and that you can't do it at a summary judgment stage. Now, if you do determine that good public policy requires the recognition of negligent supervision as a cause of action, then it ought to follow that good public policy says that that should be insured. And I'm now moving beyond this argument of looking at the words of the exclusion, the insured or an insured. And you have to realize that inside of the St. Paul policy, they made a very conscious decision. In some of the exclusions, they use an insured, any insured. In the liquor liability exclusion, the medical expense exclusion, the pollution exclusion, but in this exclusion, the intentional act exclusion, they said just the insured. But now I want to move beyond that. It's good public policy for you to declare if there is a cause of action for negligent supervision, that it is covered. Because if it's not covered, you've exposed defendants who now have this liability exposure. You've left them without the insurance coverage that ought to go along with it.
Mr. Gass, you're arguing that we interpret a contract and the words of the contract based on our subjective discernment of what constitutes good public policy?
No. I think you can review those words straight on their face. No semantics, but what I am saying to you is that when you read the words the way a normal person would read those words, you also have the assurance that you are doing good public policy. It is very much like what this court did when it decided that punitive damages were covered unless there was an explicit exclusion. You left to the marketplace to deal with that, and the carriers have dealt with it very, very well. And so if you decide negligent supervision is a separate cause of action and it is covered, the marketplace is going to take care of that. And it will achieve all sorts of public policy goals, remedies for wrongs, and protecting insureds with the appropriate coverage. So at the end of the day here, I think we're arguing on the sides of the angels that good public policy supports what a good reading of this policy allows. The other thing,
Mr. Gass, let me interrupt and ask you about something you just touched on a few minutes ago, and that was slander and slander of title. Do they really come from the same roots? Are they historically joined in some way?
That's what, it seems strange to be in a court of this eminence and be citing to CJS. But our issue is, what would be the reasonable expectations of an insured? That's the issue we debate. And I think when we look to something like CJS or Amger, and we see slander of title inside of the treatment of libel and slander, and as we quote in our brief, the law has just developed that it's part of slander. I think we're right. And I think we're right for a second reason. St. Paul could have made slander a defined term and say, as in the Bank One case, it's only slander to the person or to the goods. But So we've got an example in the Bank One case versus Bankers where it did say that, but here we have a broad undefined term.
But the slander of title, the underlying facts that create the cause of action, is a filing of a lien against the property, isn't that correct?
Right.
And this is an insurance policy covering a radio station against slander.
But wouldn't it,
if I'm a radio station, and the question, of course, that we have to ask in these questions is what is the reasonable expectations of the insured? I think a good argument can be made that's a bit difficult for you to overcome, that the kind of slander I would anticipate is not the filing of a common law lien in a county clerk's office or wherever you file them, but rather something that is said over the radio station.
Right. That's why we come back first full circle to where I started with you at the very beginning. The breadth of their activities and the fact that they bought two insurance policies. They bought my policy, which is broadcast defamation.
Are you arguing that it is reasonable for the insured, you here, WVCY, to expect that the policy that they wrote with St. Paul would cover them if one of their employees were to file a lien against the property of some citizen?
Looking at that broad term slander, under personal injury coverage, absolutely yes. Because I think it's part of the reasonable expectations, and the reason why I feel so good about that is because just a plain old encyclopedia tells us that. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gatz. Mr. Anderson.
Hey, please, the court. My name is Arnie Anderson, and I'm representing St. Paul Fire Marine Insurance Company, the intervener defendant, and responded in this matter. We've covered a number of issues so far, and as a preliminary matter, I'd like to just tick off two or three and then get to what I perceive to be the central issue and the reason that we're here, and that's the difficulty in determining where does negligent supervision fit in, how does insurance apply, and how do we as litigants and you as a court deal with these problems in an employment setting. First of all, I want to address privacy. I haven't addressed that issue. I'm relying upon the statute. And my view is that the statute says if it's not raised, you cannot argue it unless the court orders otherwise. The court hasn't ordered otherwise. I haven't briefed it. I haven't looked at it. I have nothing to say about that. There's also been references to the slander of title. I hope to be able to talk about that at the end, but chances are that I may not. Therefore, I just want to mention two or three things. First of all, slander of title is sought to be brought in under the personal injury coverage. If this court were to rule that slander of title, that is a term slander, it's drawn up, and I think one of the cases that are cited, Kensington Development, 142, second, 894, talks in detail about then how this fog is growing up in this term slander of title. If this court were to determine that under personal injury coverage, personal injury coverage that this covers damage to property, which is what it is, this would be a first, from my knowledge in this country, that any court has determined that damage to property comes within the term of slander as it's used. And we cite a California case in that regard.
Mr. Anderson, what about the Michigan Court of Appeals case that looks at the issue of the term slander? What would be your response to that? Because they did indeed find that slander included slander of title.
It was brought in on the bodily injury property damage portion of the policy, not a personal injury coverage. The California case deals with personal injury, and they state flat out they know of no case that's held that a claim of damage to property, which is what this is, comes within personal injury.
Is the California approach the majority approach as far as those courts that have looked at this issue?
I always hate majority and minority because we're dealing with maybe two or three cases.
Exactly.
And those are the only... Our case, Bank One, didn't have any problem in finding, for example, goods and things of that nature didn't include, that didn't include a personal injury, as I recall. But counsel's right, the wording is different, where in the Bank One case, the slander goes on in the definition. Ours just simply stops at libel and slander. I don't think that, when you look at the definition of what personal injury encompasses, I don't think the fact that that's undefined is the beginning and end of the definition. There's also been talk about what the reasonable expectations are of the insured. That always bothers me when we use those terms, because I think we have to be careful in that when are we leaving the objective reasonable expectations, and objective, I mean what the words and phrases say, and then we float into, well, what the insured would expect, and I've yet to hear a case where they didn't expect to be covered no matter what the circumstances are, based on the type of policy. I think if you look at the word, the setting, slander, as it's used in the personal injury coverage, a reasonable construction, a reasonable insured reading that word is going to come to the conclusion that this includes injury to persons or organizations. It does not include injury to property, in this case, slander of title.
Is there a link between the alleged injury to property and the allegations in regard to emotional distress concerning Ms. Doyle?
Well, let me, let's get into negligent supervision, because really that's what, I think that's what your question is based on. I believe we have to understand that when we, as this case is now being presented, on the key issue as I see it is negligent supervision, there is no coverage for the underlying acts that have occurred. As it's now brought to this court, the question is when you have not only acts, but acts that are excluded under a policy, and if you go through the complaint, and by the way, this is not a determination based on affidavit, as indicated by counsel. The determination in this case is based on two things, the complaint and the policy. There are no affidavits involved here. You look at the complaint and you look at the allegations, the factual allegations, and in determining whether or not the duty to defend is triggered, we look at the factual allegations, not the theories, but the facts. And you go down those allegations and what they are, I don't think it's surprising that the trial court and the court of appeals found this policy doesn't cover these actors and these acts. Now comes the question, all right, if you don't cover those actors and those acts, then what about WVCY? Is there coverage for WVCY for what they call negligent supervision? And I've struggled with that, and I think you can see that in the brief, and counsel was correct when they said that I used the wrong term when I tried with a broad brush to put everything under vicarious liability. And I shouldn't have done that. I should have been more careful. And they pointed me in the direction in the LLN case. And if you look at that case, that breaks it down to two different items. And you've already talked about them. Number one is respondeat superior, let the master answer. Number two is negligent supervision. I think there are three questions that have to be asked in a case like this, in any case in, of this nature. Number one, does the complaint establish that respondeat superior should apply? In other words, are the acts in the complaint within the scope, or they state that it's within the scope of employment? Number two, is there a claim for negligent supervision? And understand, and again, the LLN case that was pointed out by counsel, there is negligent supervision if the actor knew or should have known of the dangerous propensity. Question number three, is a dependent or independent cause? Dependent cause. You can hire a thief, you can negligently train a thief, and you can negligently supervise a thief, but there's no liability until the thief steals something. That's dependent. That negligent supervision, that negligence is dependent upon the act of the actor. What are independent causes? I don't need to go out to any hypothetical. We can look at the basic case of Lauber versus Bowling. Lauber was a case where you had a fellow that was going up the side of the barn and then a rigging. And they had the rigging on one end, and he's going to nail some boards on the barn, and he was being pulled by an automobile. And so the homeowner's insurer said, well, we don't cover this because when the rope unraveled and the guy fell down, it rose out of the use of the automobile. And this court in Lauber said, no, we've got to look and see whether or not they're independent, concurrent causes. That is, could this fellow have fallen down? Could the rope have unraveled no matter what was pulling it? And that acted on the injury. Or was it the automobile? Or was it both? And they were sent it back. Attorney Johnson's hypothetical, where he has, I believe it was Mr. Eliason standing at the top of the stairs, and he hits somebody, and then Mr. Eliason falls down, but he falls because there's not a railing on the stairs. We've got two causes. We've got the dependent cause. There's no coverage for Eliason hitting, but we've got an independent cause of the railing not being there. We don't have any exclusion for negligence on the maintaining the railing. The company wouldn't exclude that. So we'd have two independent causes going. One covered, one not covered.
Seems like you're mixing the phrase independent and dependent. I mean, they're independent, but there's a condition precedent in order for the others to apply. There would be no broken railing if the initial action had not occurred. So where does all of this independent and dependent get us?
The same place I think it did with Bowling. In the hypothetical, I don't know if it would be, strictly speaking, independent or not, because one is going and then one causes the other.
That's why I asked the question.
Yes. And that may truly not be an independent cause. And the hypothetical I was trying to illustrate the differences between them.
Mr. Anderson, does the complaint here give us any specificity with respect to the what amounted to the negligent supervision?
Well, it's our position that you never get to that in this case.
I know that.
Because it's within the scope of employment, respondeat superior, and therefore those acts, everything in this complaint is attributable to WVCY. The other, what you get into with negligent supervision is that knew or should have known. I don't think from reading the complaint there's anything to indicate anything other than WVCY knew what was going on. That all of the allegations of the complaint, starting with the broadcasting, the repeated broadcasting, the involvement of Eliason, who is a owner and officer of the corporation, everything in that case, everything in the complaint indicates that WVCY knew. When you're looking at negligent supervision, you also have the case, I believe it's Jessica. There's so many different. There's Terry, but I think it's Jessica where the claim was against the grandmother for not keeping track of her husband who sexually assaulted the grandchildren, and the claim there was that they negligently supervised. She knew or should have known of her husband's proclivities, and they said that took it out and there was no coverage for that. In all candor, I think the court needs to determine, make a distinction between the knew or should have known. Cases cited by the appellants, even those that deal with negligent supervision, if you read a couple of those cases closely, they'll say that when they knew, that this was going on, that that precludes coverage. That's a known quantity, and the intentional act exclusion applies. So, first of all, the first question, respondeat superior, we think that, as the Court of Appeals said, really, the Court of Appeals said that all of these acts are acts of WVCY within the scope of employment. It's all attributable to them, therefore the intentional acts exclusion applies. The next step is that they knew or should have known. We think the complaint establishes that they knew, and therefore the intentional acts exclusion applies. Should have known may be a closer question, but I believe the complaint indicates, Jessica, for example, indicates when it's new or should have known that there is no coverage. And then you get on, move on to the cause, and that is when you have in excluded acts that you have here, and the claim for negligent supervision doesn't mean anything but for the conduct that's excluded, then there is no coverage. Now, the rationale of that is in Bankert and the subsequent cases dealing with that, Sprangers. Well, all of those cases indicate that when, and by the way, Bankert involved with negligent supervision of children operating an automobile. And they said that when you get to your accident via the automobile and the automobile is excluded, you're not going to have coverage for the negligent entrustment of that vehicle or negligent supervision of that vehicle. And the court said there in Sprangers and subsequent cases that what insurance policies issue are insure are risks. And when there's a risk that's excluded, then there is no coverage.
Counsel, go ahead. I'd like to have a diversion, since Justice Babbage, do you want the same topic?
I want to stay on the same topic.
Why don't you go ahead?
Thank you, Justice Bradley. Why should it make a difference in this case whether the underlying acts were intentional or unintentional, so long as they were tortious in nature?
Well, I've been thinking about that in terms of your Walmart case. And I thought, what if we had the insurance policy for Walmart? Mm-hmm. And if we had the insurance policy for Walmart, we wouldn't be here because, from what I understand, and I haven't read it in detail, but from what I understand, the jury found that that conduct was not negligent of the part of the employees, but that they found negligent supervision. It's my recollection.
That's correct.
If that's the case, then there's nothing to be excluded. The question in my mind from an insurance company standpoint is not whether it's tortious, is it covered?
Well, of course, the reason I put it in that frame, Mr. Anderson, is because, of course, one of the issues we're debating in Walmart is whether, even if we have, or if we're going to recognize a tort of negligent supervision, does it require an underlying tort?
And I think, and I looked at that in the arguments, and maybe I shouldn't say this, but I think, in my view, what the jury did there was somewhat discriminating in that they jumped to the legal conclusion that we started off with, that let the master answer. And that they found that the master should answer because that conduct was within the scope of employment. And if you find that that conduct is within the scope of employment, then you never get to question number two, that is, were they negligent in supervising? My question from an insurance coverage standpoint would be not were they in the scope of employment, even assuming that they were, is that conduct excluded? My guess is that if the jury up there determined that that conduct was not excluded, or that there was no negligence, they're going to find that there's nothing intentional, but they did, that is, that they expected any injury or harm. And therefore, there's no exclusion that would apply. and therefore there's negligent, we'd have to cover this negligent supervision. Just as you would if, forgetting about how Mr. Eliason is going down the stairs, whether the individual is going down the stairs, but all of a sudden then if they're going down the stairs naturally, they reach and there's no railing there, there's no excluded conduct, so you can get liability for negligent supervision.
Counsel, it's your argument then if the underlying conduct is excluded under coverage, that necessarily the claim against the employer is excluded. Is that what you're arguing?
I believe so.
How does that comport with our common law development of negligence? That everyone owes a duty of reasonable care to another.
Well, if, for example, does the reasonable care, you start going on a sliding scale. You would not have insurance coverage for items that are excluded under the policy. You don't buy insurance coverage for everything. You would have, what you're saying with regard to tort law is that you have negligent acts and that negligence goes up no matter where it may end. There's a question that we're faced with from an insurance coverage standpoint is you may have liability for everything, but what does your policy cover? So with Banker, they had liability. The parents had liability for their negligent supervision, and they had liability for their negligent entrustment. They just didn't get it under a homeowner's policy when they had to get to their life when the liability arose out of the use of the automobile.
Mr. Anderson, are you finished with your response? Are you finished?
Yes.
Well, if I can go back to mine, because it took that interlude for me to get to understand the point that I was trying to make with my previous question. Let's assume that an employer knows that they should supervise a first-day person on the job, for whatever job it is, and the employer negligently fails to supervise. Just doesn't go out, stays in the office, and they send this person out. And the claim is brought for negligent supervision. Why should it make a difference whether the act of the person who caused the injury was intentional or unintentional? Because had it been unintentional, the failure to put the person out there to supervise would have prevented either an intentional or unintentional tort. And that's what I think the distinction that WBCY is making here. So that's why I asked the question, why should it make a difference whether it's intentional or unintentional? It seems to me that the gravamen of the offense is the simple failure to supervise.
And whatever the act was, the employer did not know their proclivity.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, did not know, but just as a matter of general practice, the employer should have been out there because this is a first-day person. And the first-day person on the job could either commit an unintentional act by failing to do something or could go out and slap a kid around.
Or
either way. You say, pardon?
Or blow up a building.
Or blow up a building, yes. So.
Or commit a sexual assault.
Yeah.
And in those cases, they've said that, at least Jessica says, in a number of cases say that under those circumstances, you don't get insurance coverage when the act causing that is intentional and excluded by the policy.
But if the employer had acted in the absence of negligence and had sent somebody out there, then there would have been no, at least arguably, no damage.
Give me that again, Jeff. What's this?
If there hadn't been negligent supervision in my example, and the way there wouldn't have been negligent supervision is for the employer would have gone out and stood alongside this trainee, then at least arguably the trainee could not have either accidentally blown up the building or intentionally blown up the building.
Right.
And I think that's the point that the plaintiffs are making here, that there's coverage under this policy for the failure to negligent, for the failure to supervise.
Okay. And our,
it's tough. We're all wrestling with it.
I know. I came down on the difference between knew or should have known in some cases. That if they knew about it or should have known about it, there's no coverage. What you're now talking about is that there is no negligent supervision.
Because they did not supervise, they were negligent in supervising.
But the definition of negligent supervision is that they knew or should have known about the dangerous proclivity of this actor.
I see.
If they don't know anything, and they should have known anything, this person comes to work and they don't have a clue that he's a firebug, and they have to keep an eye on him, and goes in the back room and starts a fire, the claim for negligent supervision is going to fail. All I'm saying is that if you want to apply the claim for negligent supervision, then look, as directed to me in the LLN case, to look at the definition of negligent supervision. And when that negligent supervision gets to the point where they knew or should have known, that brings them into the exclusion. I'll grant you that when you get to the should have known, it may be a little dicey. I think the Carney case, the federal case, looked at the should have known aspect of it, found there wasn't anything alleged. But that becomes more difficult.
But can't there be a duty to supervise, and the duty is, under law, a reasonable supervision, exercising of reasonable supervision, regardless if they knew or should have known of the propensities of any individual actor? I mean, there can be a negligence in supervision regardless of that.
I'm just playing in the ballpark set up by this court in LLM.
Yeah, but that's not in the context of a...
Where they said, therefore, an employer is liable for negligent supervision only if it knew or should have known that its employee would subject a third party to an unreasonable risk of harm. And if that's the definition, and I look at that, and then I look at Jessica that said that the grandmother knew or should have known, and therefore we're not going to provide coverage for negligent supervision.
And that's true in the context of that case. My point is that there can be a duty to supervise regardless of the supervise regardless of the propensities of any one actor.
Sure, you got an obligation to do it, but if you're now talking about the independent tort of negligent supervision,
let me just have a momentary deviation back to your first comment. Your first comment, I thought, were going to respond to Attorney Gass's argument, and you did so just by saying this case has nothing to do with affidavits. I characterize, in part, his argument as that this case must be reversed because the trial court erred in determining intent by affidavits. Is there any more response that you have to that argument other than this case has nothing to do with affidavits?
I'm not so sure if I followed the argument, but as I understand it, it was... And based on the brief, there's not an exception to the exception, but it's not an exclusion to the exclusion, it's an exception to the exclusion. And the exception to the exclusion is that these folks are out there doing what they're doing to prevent bodily injury to the unborn. And therefore, that should cover. As I think I understand the argument, I don't think, as I've indicated in the brief, that the term bodily injury and using that exclusion is going to be extended to the point where you're now going out there on the line somewhere acting, as it's indicated in this complaint, doing those kind of acts in order to protect the unborn, whatever that means.
What is bodily injury? How does that tie in, your understanding of how that ties in with his argument of the court determining intent by affidavit?
I don't know.
Do you have any response to his argument?
That bodily injury to the unborn, is that this is bodily injury?
his argument, let me focus. Part of an example was the negligent notarization. So there are many causes of action here other than the invasion of privacy, the slander, title, and negligent supervision there. And that the trial court erred in deciding some of those by summary judgment when you had to address intent, and you can't do that by affidavit and summary judgment. I think that that's a summarization of my understanding of his argument. Can you respond to that?
Well, I don't think those issues are before us. Because as this case, as I understand it, and as it's been briefed and presented in the petition review, the only underlying claim at issue is not is count nine, the slander of title. There's no claim being made, as I understand it, that any of the underlying acts are indeed covered.
We have two separate petitions for review here.
Yes.
Do either of those two separate petitions for review cover what you, what Mr. Gass argued?
Not to my knowledge. You've got privacy, which we've talked about. You've got slander of title. You've got the so-called complaint test, which I would urge the court to adhere to the complaint test. And those are the only, and negligent supervision. Those are the only issues that are raised. That's the only thing that's been briefed. That's the only thing I know about. The first time I heard it, ever heard about this negligence and notarizing something was today. And that is an underlying cause. There's no claim being briefed, argued, or I guess argued, but nothing being briefed in there in the petition review that raises any issue about somehow that negligence notarizing is a covered act under the policy. One final thing, the complaint test, there hasn't been much argued about that. I would urge the court to do as the Court of Appeals did, and that's ignore its own case, Berg versus Fall. The only time I ever see that case cited is in a bar fight. And it's come to my, at least my view, to be the bar fight exclusion where there's nothing but intentional acts alleged, and we hear, well, gee, you got Berg versus Fall, and why don't you pay something? Because you're going to have to defend. I think it's an anomaly. I think that the complaint test is a test that works. I think if we go outside the complaint test,